Okay, well, thank you very much. It's always a huge pleasure to come back out here. So what I'm going to talk about today is some work, mostly work that I did with Shamit Kachru, Oliver DeWolf, and Alexander Gurevets a few months ago, looking at some enumeration problems of flux vacua with various particular features like supersymmetry and discrete symmetries. I'll also mention at the end some more recent work, partly with Johan de Jong, who's a mathematician at MIT, which says a little bit more about some of the questions I'll raise in the talk. So here's the outline. I'm going to start by getting everyone motivated. That's what this is for. Then I'll talk about some of the tools we use to try to analyze a bunch of particular flux compactifications. And I think some of these tools are potentially quite interesting for a variety of questions. So they're somewhat unusual and involve some number theory type issues. So they're perhaps unfamiliar to most of you. So I'll spend a little bit of time on that. And then I'll talk about some specific examples of flux compactifications and what you can learn by applying these tools to counting those. And I'll end up with some lessons and speculations, as is customary. So here's the motivation. All right, so I think we all agree that we need a better global picture of string theory. We need some way of talking about all the different string backgrounds and furthermore off-shell physics connecting those backgrounds in a common language. We need some kind of configuration space and action or some formalism in which we can talk about all of string theory rather than just quantizing around particular backgrounds. And the reason that I think it's becoming more and more important that we come up with such a picture is to address cosmological questions. Obviously, this is important to address issues of vacuum selection. String theory, as we all know, has at least many supersymmetric vacua and possibly many non-supersymmetric vacua. So we want to figure out which one of these we live in. We want to address the issue of the cosmological constant. What happens in the early or late universe? Perhaps in the very early universe, we need to talk about something more like a wave function on this space, something like that. But the point is we need some framework in which to think about a broader picture than individual string backgrounds. So there are two somewhat unrelated recent approaches people have taken to aspects of certain problems in string theory, which I think both bear on this problem. The first one is what I was working on for a number of years, which is string field theory. The essence of string field theory is to try to construct a background-independent formulation of string theory, which really means finding a set of degrees of freedom and an action so that all of string theory with all the different backgrounds appear in a common formalism. And so the picture from Sen's open string tachyon conjectures that arose when we did various calculations of the tachyon potential could be viewed in a sense as a part of this sort of landscape where the open string tachyon might be viewed as a piece like this, where the tachyon would roll down to some vacuum. We found in this context of string field theory good evidence that string field theory describes multiple distinct vacua, at least in the open string context, and there's evidence that similar things are true for closed strings. But there are technical problems with using this formalism to really give us a global picture. There are gauge fixing issues and there are field redefinition issues which make it very difficult to really have a global picture of string theory from this point of view. So I'll turn to the other approach which people have talked about a lot recently, the so-called string landscape, which I really am just going to mean by that some region in the more general global picture of string theory where we can approximate things by an effective field theory, where there's something which we can loosely describe as a potential for a bunch of scalar fields and a four-dimensional gravity theory which couples to those fields, that we can talk about an effective four-dimensional theory in that region. So this is another context in which people draw pictures like this, and there's been obviously a lot of discussion of this. But from either of these two approaches, string field theory or the landscape, we're still lacking general principles with which to really define the theory and a real definition of the theory which we can use to systematically carry out complete calculations. So this is, I think, a very important problem, sort of one of the essential problems in string theory right now. And so I'm going to take, rather than in my previous talks here, I've always been talking about string field theory, and today I'll talk more about the second point of view, talking about particular string vacua, and in particular using flux vacua as a tool for controlling some of the, at least the extremal points on that picture I just showed you. So we're going to study flux vacua in type 2B string theory as a model to gain some insight into this space of possible string solutions. So my motivation here is less to try to find some phenomenological compactification than to try to understand just the space of all string compactifications with an eye towards building a more global picture like the one I just talked about. But from now on, I'll basically specify to these type 2B flux compactifications, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. So Steve and Joe and Shamit did a lot of work on this, which pioneered some of the work people have done in type 2B for this. I'm sure you've all heard some about that. But let me just remind you of some of the key features that come in when you have a type 2B flux compactification. So we have some Calabi-Yau. We have a 10-dimensional manifold, which is basically a fibered by a Calabi-Yau manifold X over R4. So we have a compact 6 manifold, a 3 complex dimensional manifold. And this has non-trivial cycles around which we can wrap fluxes of the Ramond-Ramond and NSNS 3-form. So we can have 3-form flux wrapping any of the B3 distinct topological cycles, where B3 is 2 plus 2 H2 1, and H2 1 is the number of complex structure moduli parameterizing this Calabi-Yau manifold. So the great thing about turning on these fluxes is that they stabilize some, at least, of the moduli parameterizing the manifold, which gives us an idea that we may be able to deal with the moduli stabilization problem by considering the right class of flux compactifications. So again, I'm interested in this at this point more as a model for classes of vacua rather than trying to find something which is really phenomenologically viable. So really, I'm not going to worry about stabilizing all the moduli. We also haven't really explicitly done that yet. I'm just going to focus on the axiodilaton and the complex structure moduli, and I'm going to completely ignore Kähler moduli. So even within that rather limited and simple context, I think there's some interesting lessons to be learned about, first of all, how to think about these compactifications and what kinds of questions emerge when you ask about what fraction of vacua have certain properties, even just stabilizing the complex structure moduli. So any questions so far? So this is pretty familiar to some of you. Okay. So again, let me just briefly summarize the analysis which goes into explicitly doing the stabilization of the complex structure moduli. So we want to choose a basis for the three cycles, which is symplectic. So we break the three cycles into A cycles and B cycles, and the alphas are the cohomology classes wrapping the A cycles, the betas wrap the B cycles, and the inner product is integral alpha A wedge beta B is delta B A. That's the symplectic basis. And then we choose our fluxes of F and H to wrap the A and B cycles, and these are quantized and give us integers. Getting rid of factors of 2 pi and things. So we have a set of integers, fi and hi. Each of these characterizes an integral set of fluxes through the three cycles on the manifold. And we wrap f and h along with the axiodilaton into a 3-form G. And the other piece of information we need is the periods, which are the integrals of the holomorphic 3-form. Integrals of the holomorphic 3-form around the B and A cycles. I'm choosing various combinations of A and B to get all the signs to work out right. We have various periods, pi I, and there's a Gukov-Wofford-Witten superpotential, which is W equals integral of G wedge omega, which can be rewritten in terms of the integral fluxes F and H, the axiodilaton, and the periods. So this is really the thing which controls all the moduli in this simple class of examples. We have a choice of integers, at little f and little h, and then we have an axiodilaton and some periods, and the periods are parameterized by the complex structure moduli. Right?
So phi is constant over the manifold?
Yes. So I'm going to be ignoring the warping factors that come from short distance physics on the compact manifold. Sorry, what's that?
In an F-theory compactification, it would be you're looking at a Fabia Ori interval.
Right. Sorry. Good. So you're absolutely right. I'm going to be implicitly, okay. I'm talking about orientifold models, actually, where we, I'll come to that in a minute, but we're actually going to cancel the positive flux of the C4 form and the energy also by putting in an orientifold plane, which cancels those things. And I'll pretty much suppress that throughout the talk, but I'll mention that again in a minute. So let me see, where's the appropriate point to? Yeah, so basically what I'm trying to lead up to here is a math problem that we can try to solve explicitly, allowing us to enumerate various kinds of vacua with particular kinds of conditions. So there, in order to get these things to work, there are some technical conditions related to having to put the orientifold in and getting various extra factors with that to work out. The main reason for that is you have an integral of f wedge h, which gives a tadpole, and we have to cancel that by putting in the orientifold. I'm going to assume that we've done that, and I'm just going to worry about the low energy theory that we get after doing that orientifold. Anyway, the vacuum equations coming from the superpotential, if we just, okay, we're going to ignore the Kähler moduli completely. So we're just looking at the supersymmetry equations for phi and the complex structure moduli, giving us the F-flatness conditions where dAw is partial plus W derivative of the Kähler derivative of the Kähler potential, which is explicitly given in terms of the holomorphic 3 form and the axial dilaton. The only thing you really need to know here is that we can write the Kähler potential explicitly in terms of the periods. So these are the periods. This is a symplectic matrix. We can write this explicitly. This gives us an explicit set of formulae for the Kähler derivatives, which we then have to set to 0 to get a vacuum. Okay, so we're going to try to solve these vacuum equations. And given, so there's two ways of thinking about this. We can either fix the moduli, which thus fixes the periods, and think of these vacuum equations as imposing conditions on the fluxes, G, okay, in which case, as shown by Steve and Joe and Shamit, this leads to an imaginary self-dual three-form G, so G star is equal to IG. And G has to be a linear combination of a 2, 1, and 0, 3 form. So this is one way of thinking about this. We fix the moduli, and then we have some constraints on the fluxes. Okay. Another way of thinking about it is that if we're given the fluxes, these equations, these F-flatness conditions, impose H2, 1, plus 1 conditions on the moduli. So we can fix the integral fluxes, and then think of these as equations determining the moduli. And we have the same number of equations as unknown, so generically this is the solution. Okay. So Mike Douglas, and followed up with in work with his collaborators Ashok and Deneff, has a statistical approach to thinking about enumeration of such vacua. So the basic idea here is very simple. We think about a space of fluxes. So we have a 2B three-dimensional space with the various fluxes. And because these are integral, we have a lattice in this space. And then we want to fix some region in the moduli space. So we might choose one modular domain in the moduli space, or we might choose a smaller region of the moduli space. Because we have the same number of equations as moduli, generically, for any choice of fluxes, there's order one solutions. Furthermore, all the equations, because W is linear in the fluxes, all the equations are linear in the fluxes, and therefore the space of solutions in a given region in moduli space looks like a cone. Okay, so if we restrict the moduli to a fixed region and then ask which fluxes are compatible with those with that range of modular parameters, we get a cone. Okay. Now here's where the orientifold comes in. Furthermore, there's a tadpole given by integral of f wedge h. We need to fix that tadpole, we need to cancel the tadpole, which we do by doing an orientifold. Now, in a physical model, fixing that will require choosing a specific orientifold, which gives a particular amount of D3 brain charge. And that negative D3 brain charge coming from the orientifold will have to be canceled by a combination of this D3 brain charge and D3 brain charge from axial D3 brains. We'll call that upper bound L. In a given physical model, L would be a fixed number depending on the orientifold. This is where I'm saying we're just going to describe this as a math problem. I'm going to take L as an arbitrary parameter. I'm not going to worry about what particular orientifold we're taking. If we're doing it on the torus, we might have L equal 64 or 16. I'm just going to take that as a general parameter and ask about the numbers of solutions we can find and how they scale as L. And obviously, for a particular model, you would then need to choose what L was and do a more specific enumeration. But I'm going to think about this as a math problem motivated by this so that we can consider taking L to be very large and look at the asymptotics. Okay, so the tadpole condition tells us that this integral, f wedge h, has to be less than or equal to some fixed value L, which really comes from an orientifold, but I'll just take as an upper bound, and we'll call that nf. So geometrically, that just means that the fluxes we're considering have to lie under some hypersurface, this red hypersurface, which I've written as HL. Okay, so the counting problem, which is addressed by Douglas et al., is count the number of lattice points in the cone under the hypersurface, right? So because here you're counting the number of points in a 2B three-dimensional volume, if we take L to be very large, that's like taking the lattice spacing to be very small, the number of points in a region of space, number of lattice points in a region of space that has the same dimension as the lattice, is just given by the volume divided by the lattice spacing to the dimension. So we expect that the number of vacua is going to scale as the square root of L to the 2B3. 2B3 is the dimension of the space. The square root of L is the scale factor that comes in because this constraint is a quadratic constraint. So we expect a scaling that goes something like the number of vacua goes as L to the B3. I'll just comment that if we take a finite region in the moduli space, then this thing here is compact as I've drawn it. There's a technical issue, which is if we include boundary points, so a complete modular region, this thing can actually run off to infinity. And as you see, this hyperbolic surface has regions which go off to infinity. So there are places where this intersection C intersected with the space under the hypersurface is actually non-compact. And you can actually get anomalous behavior associated with that, which I'll come back to presently. Okay, but the point of this is that Douglas et al. Have a very nice way of doing this systematically, and what they've computed is essentially the coefficient appearing in this scaling law, and furthermore, that coefficient as a function on the moduli, as a distribution on the moduli space. So the point is that you can take any region in the moduli space and compute the expected number of vacua as an integration of this power of L times the integration of the appropriate measure on moduli space, which they have a closed form expression for in terms of R and omega, the curvatures and things on the moduli space. So that's a quick summary of what Mike Douglas et al. Have been doing to statistically estimate the number of vacua given this upper bound condition of 2B string theory. So any questions about that? Okay. So what I want to do now, and what we were studying, is a more specific question, which is, let's now ask, if we put additional constraints on the vacua we're interested in, like let's say we insist that W equals zero, that the superpotential vanishes, which in these no-scale models, because D Kähler W equals W, that corresponds to supersymmetry. Or if you could ask about discrete symmetries, which vacua have these special properties? So this gives us a set of questions that we can ask. There's the questions which Douglas et al. Have begun to address. How many vacua exist with NF less than or equal to L, and how do they scale with L? What's the distribution on the moduli space? And then we can ask these more specific questions. What's the fraction of vacua with W equals zero? What's the fraction of vacua with certain discrete symmetries, et cetera? So again, these first two questions were addressed by Douglas et al., and we've done a bunch of explicit calculations. Other people have also done calculations which confirm what they did, and we can also address the range of validity of some of their assumptions using some of these explicit calculations we do in particular models. But for questions 3 and 4, these kinds of fractions, I'll argue we really need some new methods to solve those problems. We can't use the same picture that I just put up. And I think it's important to start to try to address these questions because you know, whatever you think of the arguments about application of anthropic reasoning and stuff like that, which I won't talk about at all, to this vacuum problem, it looks like there may be lots of vacua in string theory, and it behooves us to try to understand those vacua. In particular, do they generically have certain properties, or do they generically not have certain properties? So a concrete analytic result on the ratio of vacua with these various properties might help us to address phenomenologically interesting questions, like questions about low energy supersymmetry. Discrete symmetries may tell us something about proton decay. There are a lot of phenomenological reasons why we want to know what the different vacua of string theory look like. So what I'm talking about is really motivated just by trying to understand what do the different vacua of string theory look like and how many are there. So again, these 2B flux compactifications where we just fixed the complex structure moduli is sort of a toy model for a space of string vacua. Okay, so here's how these problems I'm now raising are different than the Douglas et al. Approach. We can draw the same picture. We have a cone, and the intersection of the cone and the region under the hypersurface is this purple region. So we still want to look at points in the purple region, but now we have additional constraints. We have additional exact constraints, and these are essentially hypersurfaces, which we then have to intersect with the previous space. So now, instead of counting points in a region which has the same dimensionality as the volume of fluxes, now we want to count points on a hypersurface, on some lower dimensional space. We want to count lattice points. And that's essentially a number theory problem, right? Anytime you're trying to solve a system of equations over the integers instead of over the reals, that becomes number theory. That's one of the things that number theorists do, is they write down complicated equations and try to count how many solutions those equations have. And they have systematic ways of talking about asymptotic estimates, which I'll mention shortly. So I want to emphasize that these kind of counting problems are generically very hard. It seems like you're not changing much. All you're doing is putting in an additional constraint, right? But take a simple polynomial equation, right? X to the n plus y to the n minus z to the n, where n is some fixed number, like 5, say. You could ask, how many integral solutions are to that equation? And it took mathematicians a long time to figure that out. It's not something you can do by just saying, well, you know, we just put a delta function in and approximate the thing by the number of lattice points on a surface. The nature of the problem changes qualitatively when you put an additional exact constraint in.
But if you do that, you get more or less the right answer, right? I mean, Fermat's theorem is kind of statistically true.
Absolutely. In many cases, you get roughly the right answer, and then there are cases where you don't. Yeah. So actually, Fermat's, you're very good. Fermat's case is actually not particularly a great example because the dimensionality, if you just do it naively, is roughly the same. You can be off when you do this. In particular, you might get log factors and things that you're off by. You have to be careful when you're doing that. And that's what number theorists do. They're careful about trying to do these kinds of things. And you find that sometimes your naive expectation works, and other times it doesn't.
If you do a naive calculation, you get 0.
If you do a naive calculation, you get order 1, I think.
And then you check a volume, and it becomes order a tenth, order a hundredth. So there's a sense in which you can check in certain ways and guess how much volume is left.
No, but you're checking explicitly, not by statistical.
Right, right. But you do near the origin implicitly and farther out by statistical lines.
Yeah, but so there are other cases where, for instance, if we have several equations, it's much harder to make that kind of argument. So in particular, if you have a system of 2 or 3 equations, it's pretty much impossible to generically have this kind of physics-based argument for how many points there are on the intersection of hypersurfaces. Let me emphasize one thing, which is if instead of having an exact constraint, we had an approximate constraint. Like, let's say our constraint was the mass of the top is between lower bound and upper bound. Then, actually, if the lattice spacing is sufficiently dense, the problem is not a number theory problem, because as long as there's a finite region and your lattice spacing is very small compared to that, then you're still looking at the number of points in a volume. But then you have a trade-off between how big is L really, because as I mentioned in the physical cases, L is a finite number, which we can calculate, and what's the range that you're actually allowing on your parameter. But the things I'm talking about where we either have or don't have supersymmetry, or we have or we don't have a discrete symmetry, these are discrete things, which you either have or you don't, and therefore they're determined by additional equations which have to be satisfied exactly. Okay.
And you're interested in knowing how many solutions lie on this special surface
relative to number in the volume?
Well, really, I just want to know how many are there on the special surface, and then I've already calculated how many there are in the volume, so I can take the ratio. I mean, there's no reason I'm more interested in the well, there is a reason I'm more interested in the ratio. The ratio tells you about, I mean, I don't even want to go there, but... you can imagine if there were 37 vacua, and 36 of them had supersymmetry and one didn't, then you might think differently about things than if you had 65,000, you know, a Google vacua, and one of them did have supersymmetry and the others didn't. You know.
Right, but truly the scaling at large will always tell you the number of things that lie on your hypersurface is small compared to the number of things in the volume.
Well, but one question is it exponentially suppressed or is it polynomially suppressed? That's, I mean, so there are people who would argue that that distinction can make a difference between whether low energy supersymmetry should be observed at the LHC or not. I will not make that argument. I really just want to understand what are the vacua, what are their properties, and let's just try to understand them better. Because I don't think we're in any kind of a state to start making statements about what we can predict or not, because we don't even know what the vacua are. So I really just want to understand what the vacua are and which ones have certain properties. And this seems to lead to some interesting stuff. So let's see where it goes. So we used three different approaches to try to solve these problems. One was that in certain cases, you can still use a continuous approximation, because for some reason, you're still in a volume where you can get a lattice of the same dimensionality. For instance, if this is a linear constraint, then you can still think of it as a continuous thing. We used discrete methods, as in number theory. And we use numeric methods, putting a Monte Carlo on a computer, and usually we use two or three of these methods to sort of check what we were doing to make sure that it all made sense. And the goals of this exercise were, first of all, to check the formalism of Douglas and Ashok and Deneff to make sure that what they're saying makes sense and that it's valid in a fairly wide range of situations. And second of all, to develop techniques for these over-constrained systems where we have an extra constraint. I won't talk too much about the checks, because basically most of the things we checked, except for some limiting asymptotic conditions, pretty much agrees with their formalism. So they're right, and that's good. But I think it's more interesting to talk about the second part, the techniques for over-constrained systems, which is where maybe you have something slightly new to say. OK, any questions so far?
Well, look at what you were checking. I mean, you were now applying your methods without this extra hypersurface, and you said you get the same result?
Yeah, some of those methods I mentioned we applied without the hypersurface, and some of them we applied with the hypersurface. In the cases without the hypersurface, we compare, I mean, problems one and two, we compare to what they got. In other cases, we just did the calculation, which hadn't been done. OK, so now let me talk about tools. OK, so there are two ideas which we use to analytically explore the space of solutions, which are slightly unfamiliar to many of us. So let me review these things. The first one is algebraic number fields, which are basically extensions of the rationals by some finite set of additional objects, which turn them into a bigger field than just Q. Now you might ask, why are we doing this? So the reason I care about number fields is because we started out by looking at some examples and found that in many examples, the periods of the varieties we were looking at, the periods of the Calabi-Yau we were looking at, lay in algebraic number fields. And I will come later on to some discussion of how generic we expect that to be. But certainly lots of cases we looked at had this property. And then we found that we could find some tools where if we made the assumption that the periods lie in number fields, we can actually make some nice estimations of the numbers of vacua. So just bear with me for a little bit as I review or tell you what a number fields are. So,
Lottie,
yes?
You can continuously deform the complex structure. Doesn't that continuously change your periods?
Yes, but you don't have solutions at continuously varying complex values of the complex structure. We only have solutions at a finite. Remember, I drew this picture, right? We have a region, and there's a finite number of discrete solutions.
For fixed fluxes, you fix complex structure.
Right, and there's a finite number of those possible fluxes because we have this upper bound, integral of f wedge h.
Why?
Yes.
Number fields also show up in the attractor mechanism.
Absolutely, and I'll mention that at the end. That's absolutely an interesting. I mean, it's actually closely related in some ways, and I'll mention that at the end. So some of you who have seen Greg Moore talking about the attractor mechanism in black holes may have seen some related things. Good point. Yeah, there's actually a couple places where people talk about it. Also, Candelas et al. Have been looking at some related things of looking at Calabi-Yau's with finite fields. But anyway. So there's a number of number fields. Let me just mention some examples which will be of interest. One is if we just include I with Q, then we can write an arbitrary element of this number field as A plus BI, where A and B are rational. And the degree of extension of this number field over Q is 2. We can extend Q by the square root of minus D, which is very similar. Now we have A plus B root DI. D is some integer. This is, again, a degree 2 extension of the rationals. And then we have the so-called cyclotomic fields, where we extend Q by a kth root of unity. So if alpha to the k equals 1, we have linearly independent terms for each k prime, which is relatively prime to k. So the number of such k prime is the Euler-Totient function phi of k, the number of relatively prime integers to k less than k. So this is another number field which appears in some of the examples we'll look at. So we have a bunch of number fields. And now let me explain why this is useful. Imagine we knew that the periods and the axial dilaton for a particular Calabi-Yau compactification took values in a number field f, where the degree of extension of f over q is d. Then each of our equations that we're trying to solve, dw equals 0, would be d equations over the rationals. Okay, it's just like what we usually do when we have a system of equations over the complexes. Every equation over the complexes can be thought of as a real part of the equation and an imaginary part of the equation. And if we have a field of extension degree D, that's just D equations because there's one for each of the possible things. For instance, for the cyclotomic fields, we can write a basis as 1, alpha, alpha squared, etc. We then can find a separate equation for the coefficient of each of the terms in this expansion. That gives us D equations. So we have D equations over Q for these flatness conditions. So this immediately tells us how we expect the scaling of the number of solutions to go, which have a particular set of periods and axial dilaton. Namely, the solution should go as root L to the 2B3, which we had before. And then we have a system of equations. The number of equations is D times the number of DW equations, which is B3 over 2. So we get a minus B3D over 2. So this is now our expectation for the number of solutions for a particular value of pi and phi in this field F. If we also include the constraint W equals 0, we can do that very easily by just changing the equation by putting a minus D in the exponent, because we have essentially D additional equations coming from W equals 0. Right, so this is giving us a systematic way of talking about the number of solutions we expect based on the degree of the field extension in which the periods of the Calabi-Yau lie. Okay. Okay. The second tool, which we will find useful, is something which number theorists use all the time. It's called heights. And heights are really something very familiar, very natural to physicists. It's basically generalizing the idea of order of magnitude from the real numbers to the rational numbers. So the idea of a height is to try to give you sort of an order of magnitude estimate for rational numbers. And Diophantine geometry, which is the study of solutions of systems of equations over the integers, uses this as a basic tool for talking about asymptotics of numbers of solutions. So it's actually quite easy to see how this works in some simple forms, which are the only forms we'll use it in. Let's say we have a point x in n-dimensional projective space over Q. That means we've got an n plus 1 tuple of rational numbers. And we can always get rid of the first one by scaling, call it 1, and then we have n rational numbers. If we take that point in Pn of Q and we get rid of all the denominators and then get rid of all common multiples from the numerators, we have a set of integers m0, m1 through mn, which are all relatively prime. That is, there's no common factor of all of them. GCD of all of them equals 1. This is said to have height, which is the maximum of the absolute value of these elements. So basically, it's just saying how big is the biggest numerator or denominator that you get. It's a very simple idea. So this allows us to have something like an order of magnitude estimate for sequences or sets of rational numbers. So here's an example of a very simple use of height. So number theorists have very sophisticated ways of dealing with heights, and there's a lot of complicated things you can do with them. I'm going to be using them in an extremely simple and naive way. Basically, let's say we have a linear equation in a bunch of variables a naught through an, and we know that the capital A's are integers, and we have an equation whose coefficients are all rational. We know that the A's are all upper bounded by capital N, and we want to know how many solutions are there to this linear equation with these coefficients. So the number of solutions, it's very easy to see, is just big N to the N divided by the height of X, where X is this same 1, P1 over Q1, et cetera, that we have up there. How do we see that? Well, basically, we imagine that we choose A1 through AN from an ensemble of all possible values ranging from minus N through N. By the way, the coefficient out front isn't here. There might be a 2 to the N or something if I had the right coefficients there. So imagine that we took an ensemble for all the A's except for A naught, right? And then we replaced these P's and Q's with the M's up here. Then we have an equation M naught A naught plus M1 A1 plus all the way down through equals 0. Imagine that M naught, without loss of generality, is the biggest one, and then we choose the other A's to be arbitrary. Then basically the fraction of values of A1 through AN which will admit a solution is going to be 1 over M naught of them, because that's when you can solve the equation M naught A naught equals this linear combination of all the other A's. So 1 over M naught of the N to the N values of the other A's will admit a solution. Therefore, the number of solutions goes as N to the N, big N to the little N over H of X. Okay. So what's the point of that? The point is we can now use that to get a more refined estimate of the number of solutions to our equations. Okay. Any questions on the basic height stuff? Okay, so let me just say a couple more things about height. So there's a lot of nice properties that these things have which allow you to manipulate them very easily. If you have a polynomial, for instance, you can define the height of the polynomial with rational coefficients to be the height of the set of coefficients. If you do that and then you take the product of two polynomials, then generically the height of the product of the polynomials is just the product of the heights. Similarly, we can take a general number field and think of the height of an element of that number field as just the height of the sequence of coefficients in a generic expansion of an element of that number field. So it's going to be a height as an element of an element of P d minus 1 of Q. Furthermore, we actually can easily estimate the number of points of a given height less than or equal to h in this projective space. And that goes as just h to the n plus 1 times 2 to the n. And then there's a zeta function which pops in, which it's actually easy to see. This just gets rid of all the things with common divisors. So the point of this business is that now we can refine our estimate for the number of vacua with a given upper bound L and given values of the complex structure moduli and the axial dilaton. We can take our previous estimate, but now we can note that if our periods have a known height, h, then each of our equations, as in the previous transparency, will divide the number of solutions by a factor of h. So we get an overall 1 over h to the db 3 over 2. And this actually turns out to be a crucial factor. We then can imagine, for instance, summing over all the different axial dilatons or other periods in this particular number field, and then we get some formula where we can write the number of vacua as a sum over all possible heights of phi, the height of phi to the appropriate power for the number of, so this is h phi to the d, which is the number of possible values of phi in that number field. Then we have the minus db 3 over 2, which comes from there, should be a b subscript 3, and then the L up here. So this gives us a rough estimate for the number of solutions we expect, where we now are summing over the axial dilaton, or we could, in principle, also sum over the other complex structure moduli. It gives us a rough estimate of the number of states we expect to find based on these somewhat number theoretic considerations. So this actually turns out to be a very good estimate in a lot of cases. So this is one of the tools that we'll use. There are some subtleties. I should emphasize that this is not, I haven't really rigorously shown that this is true in all cases. It's a very good back-of-the-envelope way of calculating the number of flux vacua with certain properties. There are a number of subtleties which can afflict this. There are ways in which some of the number theoretic things might be a little bit off and give you extra factors of logs. We have to be careful about what the upper bound is here. And then in any given problem, there can be coincidences, which may or may not be really coincidences. They may be having to do with the structure of the equations, which changes. But in many of the situations we look at, that's a good estimate.
You said it was very rough, though, on this one.
I guess what I mean is you shouldn't look at that and think you can apply it to any example. It works fairly well for most of the examples. And I'll show you, like, for instance, an example where it's off by a log. So it shouldn't be trusted absolutely, is all I'm saying. It's a back-of-the-envelope calculational estimate, which often is right. But in some cases, there are situations where there can be subtleties. It's better than any other way I know of getting an estimate without doing all the number theory exactly. So it's a good approximation. Let me do an example just to make some of this sort of clear. So a simple example is a rigid Calabi-Yau where there are no complex structure moduli. Then life is very easy. In this case, we have just 2 3 cycles, A and B. We integrate the three former on one of them. We get one. We can choose the other one to have an integral of I. That's a particular rigid Calabi-Yau. The superpotential now is just A phi plus B, where A and B are complex integral combinations of 1 and I. Okay, so we have four fluxes, H1, H2, F1, and F2. The NF, which is integral of F wedge H now, is just F1, H2 minus H1, F2. And the vacuum equation that we want to satisfy is D phi W equals 0, which is the same as saying A phi bar plus B equals 0. So we can just solve directly for phi bar. It's minus B over A. So we see that in this particular example, we get a ratio of something in Z of I over something else in Z of I, so we get something in Q of I. So it's a rational combination of 1 and I is our phi. So here's our first example of a case where we can actually explicitly solve the equations, and lo and behold, all of our flux and our complex and our periods all lie in some number field. Okay. So now we can apply our technology that I just developed. We have B3 is 2. Dimension is 2. That means every one of our equations is really two equations, right? So now we can write down the formula. So I can write down the formula we had on the previous slide, which tells us the expected number of vacua. Here it's, so we get an L. This would have been L squared, except there are two equations, which brings us down by two factors of root L, so it's L. Those two equations bring us down by a factor of 1 over h squared. And then there are h squared possible values that phi could take. So if we sum over all possible values of phi, then the number of expected vacua is a sum of h squared times L over h squared, which actually goes as L squared. So here's where we can see the importance of keeping into account these h factors coming from the suppression. If we tried to do an estimate without keeping track of those, we would get the wrong answer. We'd get something which went as order L. So this is an example which is just calculating so far the total number of vacua. So this is something which you can calculate exactly. And this was also calculated asymptotically by Ashok and Douglas. So to do this precisely, we need to fix the SL2Z invariance. We can do that in two ways, either by fixing to live in a fundamental region, phi to live in a fundamental region, in which case we get a continuous approximation, a la Douglas et al. Or we can fix the SL2Z on the fluxes, giving us a discrete sum. And when we write down that discrete sum, we get a sum from m equals 1 to L of sigma of m, where sigma is the number of is the sum of divisors of m, which can also be written as just the sum of k over times the floor of L over k. And asymptotically, this goes as pi squared over 12 L squared. So the correct answer indeed goes as L squared. We can get the coefficient out by a more careful analysis. You can also, as was done by Ashok and Douglas, get the density on moduli space by a similar kind of argument. Okay. So this is an example where we've so far gone through the questions that Douglas et al. Have been able to address. Now let's address some of the other questions. The W equals 0 question is not very interesting for this case, because if we set W equals 0, there are no vacua, right? The W is A phi plus B. D phi W equals 0 turns into A phi bar plus B equals 0. So these two equations have no common solution unless phi is real, which is not physically interesting. So there's no W equals 0 vacua. So that's not very interesting. There are, however, some interesting discrete symmetries. There are points where phi equals I. Turns out there's order L of those. There are points where phi is e to the pi I over 3. So you can, again, get this L estimate just from the field extension that this thing lives in. If phi is e to the pi I over 3, this is not living in a rational well, it's, sorry, it's not living in, this has a, what does it say? L equals. There's a typo there. This should be phi equals e to the pi I over 3. Anyway, there are no vacua there, and the reason we can see that immediately is because we know phi has to be rational because it's minus b over a, and this is not a rational value of phi, so there's no solutions there. Now, there's another discrete symmetry which is actually perhaps a little more interesting, and this gives us an example of a more subtle version of this calculation, which I will then generalize. It's a close analogy to something I will do shortly thereafter in a more complicated model. So I'll go through it in detail in the simpler model, and then I'll just sketch it in the more complicated example. So now, this model has a discrete symmetry. If we take phi to minus phi bar, that's reflection across the positive, across the imaginary axis. This gives a symmetry of the four-dimensional theory, which turns into a CP symmetry when you match it with a space-time parity transformation. And you can ask, how many vacua are there with this symmetry? So if we use our height argument, we're now looking for the number of vacua where the real part of phi equals 0. Same analysis as before, except now we have one fewer factors of h as our number of possible phis. We have h times l over h squared. This, in principle, would go as l log l. So the question is, does it really go as l log l? We can do an exact analysis as follows. We're counting a and b, which are going to have a common factor, because we have to end up with something which is proportional to I. So they have a common factor, p plus iq, where p and q are relatively prime. And the upper bound tells us that kl times p squared plus q squared is less than or equal to l. So we can explicitly write the number of solutions as a sum. We sum across all p and q, which are relatively prime, p squared plus q squared less than or equal to l. And then if we divide out l by that, we have to find out how many products kl there are, which are less than that ratio. That's just the sum up to that number of the number of divisors of n. Now, this is something we can continuously approximate if we use this fact that getting rid of the relatively prime, getting rid of things which are not relatively prime gives us the 1 over zeta 2. So we can approximate this by an integral. We get an integral of rho over rho squared, log of L over rho squared. You do the integral, you get something proportional to L log L squared. So here's the point. In this even extremely simple example, the only way that I know to get the correct answer is to use this sort of number theory approach. And it gives a slightly different answer from the asymptotic estimate that we had based on our heights. Okay. That's the flavor of the kind of analysis. Let me just sketch briefly another couple of examples without going into the details and show you how some structure starts to emerge. Symmetric torus is the next simple example, where we take a T6, which is T2 times T2 times T2 with all the same complex structure. We can write down a symplectic basis. I won't go through the details. We can put fluxes on, parameterized by 8 integers, A0, A, B, B0, C0, C, D, D0. The superpotential is then written as a cubic polynomial in tau minus phi times another cubic polynomial in tau. P1 and P2 are cubic polynomials with coefficients, which are the A's and B's, et cetera. And then we have this upper bound, which is the quadratic form in the A's and B's and C's. And now we want to ask, what do the vacua for this look like? So the first thing is that if we solve the general equations, something sort of miraculous happens, which I don't understand, and I'll just sketch it. An exact solution of the equation of motion gives you one equation, which is P1 minus 5 bar P2 equals 0, and then P1 minus 5 P2 is equal to some complicated thing with tau and tau bar and derivatives of the P's. If we eliminate phi from these two equations, we get a quintic equation in tau and tau bar, which is looking kind of ugly. We can write tau as x plus iy, so now we have two quintic equations, the real and imaginary parts, in two variables. If we manipulate these a little bit, we find that the real and imaginary parts turn into an equation q1 of x times y squared equals q3, where q1 is linear in x, q3 is cubic. Similarly, a constant times y to the fourth is a quartic in x. If we combine those, we get something which looks like a sixth order equation. So we can just solve essentially for y squared and clear denominators. We get q1 squared times q4 equals q0 times q3 squared. Looks like a sixth order of equation. And miraculous things happen, and it turns into a simple third order equation. where the coefficients of various polynomials and the fluxes. And now we can solve for the cubic for x, and then there's a quadratic equation here for y. And that tells us that the degree of the field extension that tau lies in is at most 6. Okay. So the upshot here is, if we solve explicitly for the vacua on the torus, some algebraic miracles happen which reduce the extension degree of our periods to an extension of degree at most 6. And this is interesting because that's just small enough that if we use our formulae from the previous transparencies to estimate the number of vacua based on the degree of the field extension, these generically will give vacua. So something sort of remarkable is happening, which is pushing more algebraic structure or more arithmetic structure than we might expect on the periods so that these equations can be satisfied generically rather than by some unexpected matching. Okay. For the symmetric torus, we have a story very much like the one I told for the CP symmetry on the rigid Calabi-Yau. We can estimate by heights. We're looking for 2 cubics with a common root. We can do an explicit computation by fixing SL2Z. Now, it's very much like what we had before. We have a common factor, a common quadratic factor with a linear and a constant multiple by fixing SL2Z. Now we're trying to find a set of integers so that fk times 4ln minus m squared is less than or equal to 3l. And there's a bunch of stuff which I won't go into, but there's some mod 3 constraints which complicate it a little bit. But the point is that we're summing over integers such that this thing here, 4ln minus m squared, which is the discriminant, d, takes a certain value. We can rewrite this sum of the number of vacua as a sum over the discriminant of the class number h of the discriminant, which is a thing, very important thing in number theory, which is basically the number of lm and t such that the solution of the quadratic equation there lies in the fundamental domain. This is an interesting number theoretic object. It's the sum of d of h of d times the sum of sigma of n, the sum of the divisors of n from n up equals 1 up to l over td, where td is either d or 3d, depending on whether d is 0 mod 3. That mod 3 stuff you don't need to worry about. But the point is, there's a simple expression written in terms of number theoretic functions. David mentioned the connection with attractors. So there are some related things which happen with attractors and motivated Greg Moore to make some conjectures about arithmetic structure for attractors, which I'll mention again in a few minutes. But among other things, by making an analogy to flux vacua, at one point he made some conjecture that certain formulae like this should be writable in terms of the class number h of d. And in fact, he was spot on. We can actually do this. And we can calculate the total number of vacua. And it goes as L squared. OK, so here we have L squared, W equals 0 vacua, and L to the fourth other vacua. OK, so just again briefly, we can go on and do this for one parameter hypersurfaces. We have various one parameter models where we get rid of either we think of it as a mirror of a system with a lot of complex structure moduli and one Kähler moduli, or we just take a discrete quotient of the model so that we can only keep a very specific modular parameter. In any case, we can look at these models with one modular parameter, which are in weighted projective space, and we can do similar analyses. Running short on time here. So the periods, the important point is that at the Landau-Ginzburg point psi equals 0, the periods take values in the cyclotomic fields fk. For k equals 6, we have a degree 2 extension. For other k, we have a degree 4 extension. The general periods, we only know some rather awkward hypergeometric function, which can be written as a power series around that point. So we did all the analysis. We found vacua at the Landau-Ginzburg point for M6. And it turns out there's order L squared of them. If you look at W equals 0 vacua, again, you have this sort of sum. It looks like you're going to have L. You get a 1 over h squared, but then you multiply by h squared, as we've noted happens sometimes. So actually, there's an extra enhancement of the number of W equals 0 vacua at that point by this extra h squared appearing there, so that in fact, at the psi equals 0 point, we get the same order of L squared, of W equals 0 vacua as we have total vacua. So there's an extra enhancement there from this h dependence. And then we looked at some other models. There's vacua at M8, even though we have D equals 4, which is due to a simplification of the equations there, having something to do with the Galois group, but I won't go into that. there are discrete symmetries in various places. For instance, there's a Z2R symmetry, which tells us that W equals 0 for these things on M6. Okay, now, this is where things stood when we wrote our paper. I got kind of excited about certain aspects of this, and one aspect of this is that in every case we looked at, the periods were arithmetic. They lived in some number field. So that led to a couple of interesting ideas. One is, there's one conjecture one might make, which is maybe for all the flux vacua, the periods are arithmetic. That would imply some remarkable unexpected properties of hypergeometric functions, but nobody had proven that it wasn't the case. Furthermore, it now looks like there's lots of W equals 0 vacua, and they all seem to have this sort of property. So just more recently, I actually have gone and tested a bunch of these things. So the first question, which one might be interested in, is are all periods generically arithmetic for any flux compactification, right? So to test that, I took a particular vacuum of M8 with very small values of the fluxes and had Mathematica compute out to about 20 digits. It actually takes a long time because you have to look at a power series expansion out to 100 orders or something. Compute these things up to 20 digits, the psi and the periods, and look for any arithmetic structure. So there's all kinds of methods you can use, neat number theoretic methods to find arithmetic structure, ways of finding whether numbers satisfy polynomial equations over the rationals. So this is not conclusive, but in the study I did, there was no sign of arithmetic structure. These numbers don't seem to have any simple arithmetic structure. So again, Greg Moore made some related conjectures for attractors, type 1 and type 2 attractors. In some sense, these things, the generic vacuum is analogous to type 1 attractors, and these are analogous to type 2 attractors. This is an analog of his type 1 attractor conjectures, and in this case, it seems that there's no arithmetic structure there. So if you were inclined to conjecture that all periods are magically arithmetic, that seems not to be the case. Once you figure that out, it's not unexpected. I just felt it had to be done. I just figured this out about a week ago, so.
So you can calculate these things by expanding some kind of hypergeometric function?
Yeah, the power series I wrote previous. You have to find solutions of the equations, right? So you're solving the period equations out.
Hypergeometric function at some value, and the question is, what's the?
Yeah, and then you find the periods and find psi and calculate it out to 20 digits, and then there's various algorithms you can use for testing to see if it satisfies a polynomial equation with coefficients in the integers. And it doesn't. At least if this satisfies a polynomial equation, I was looking for something which satisfied a sixth degree polynomial equation, just like the case on the torus, where that was just the small enough degree that it was actually that result on the torus that made me think there was even a chance in hell of getting something interesting here, which was that somehow the structure simplified the arithmetic structure enough that you got a degree 6 extension, and that was exactly the limit of what you needed to get non-trivial vacua generically. So the same would have been true here. This would have to have a sixth order equation which it satisfies in order to be generically something which gives rise to vacua. And if this satisfies a sixth order equation, the coefficients in it are at least 5 digits large. And given the small size of these fluxes, I feel like, unless there's something really complicated going on that I don't understand, it's unlikely that there's a simple arithmetic structure there. So that's a negative result. Probably it is not and probably will not be published, but I thought it's worth reporting because it closes off that area, that direction of further inquiry. The other question you might ask is, how dense are these W equals 0 vacua? So Johann de Jong, a mathematician who, for his own arcane reasons, is also interested in these questions, and I did some calculations. He's actually worked on almost exactly the same problem for years from a different point of view in mathematics. So we actually scanned over all solutions of a single fpi dot pi equals 0, looking for pairs, because this is what you need for the W equals 0 vacua. So basically, we found solutions to this and then looked to see if there were pairs with different f and h, which are not linearly dependent. And we looked at about 10 to the fourth solutions and found none. So again, this seems to imply that on the quintic, there are no W equals 0 vacua, so that the existence of these W equals 0 vacua on M6 and M8 seems to have to do with the very special properties of those vacua and possibly with the arithmetic structure of the periods there. So at this point, I'm inclined to conjecture that W equals 0 vacua all have arithmetic periods, but that they're not very dense. And that's the analog of Greg's type 2 attractors conjecture. I'm at my time, so let me summarize. Okay, so one of the points of all this, as I say, at one point I was fantasizing about, some kind of number theoretical explanation for all the flux vacua. I don't think that's the case any longer, but I think that these tools for studying vacua with special properties, W equals zero in discrete symmetry, may be very handy because they are an approach to trying to solve these overconstrained systems, which are problems that you can't solve using the methods of Douglas at all. So there may be other areas in which you can apply these also, but in particular, if you're trying to look at specific classes of vacua with hypersurface type constraints, this is the only set of tools I know of that will enable you to ask those kinds of questions and answer them. So we confirmed the statistical framework of Douglas, Ashok, and Deneff. I didn't mention it, but there's lots of calculations we did verifying their predictions. And there are cases where you get things that go off to infinity and you get logs coming from that. I didn't really go into that. We did find that the arithmetic structure of the periods was important for the particular vacua we looked at, in particular for the W equals zero vacua. We found explicit solutions on the symmetric torus, and we also found some solutions on these MK things. As I say, we solved for the generic symmetric torus vacuum, which hadn't been done, and we found this nice, sort of remarkable algebraic cancellation, which I still would like somebody to explain to me. We found that in some cases, the special vacua are enhanced by these number theoretic features. As I commented at the end, it does seem that arithmetic structure and W equals zero only occur at special points, although it does still seem that all the vacua we know of with W equals zero have arithmetic structure in their periods. So it's, I think, quite plausible that that is a correspondence which holds. So where do we go from here? Well, obviously, it would be nice to look at models with large values of H21, because we've only looked at H21 equals 0 and 1. And what we really want are the asymptotics in B3, which has to do with large H21. We can make some speculations based on what we've seen, but I don't think it's quite conclusive yet. I think it would be interesting to understand better the significance of this arithmetic structure. It does seem that many of these kinds of vacua, even on Calabi-Yaus and on the torus, it's maybe not surprising that you get arithmetic periods because everything's polynomials. But it is a little more surprising that maybe all the W equals zero vacua we've found have this property. There are two other kinds of objects which are closely related. So the W equals zero vacua, remember I told you at the beginning that the vacua of flux vacua have G, which is a 2-1. It has 2-1 and 0-3 components. If there's no 0-3 component, we have a supersymmetric or W equals zero vacuum. If there's no 2-1, that's called a rank 2 attractor. So Greg Moore made conjectures saying that basically if you have just this kind of 3 form, you have arithmetic structure. What we're looking at is things which just have this structure, and they also seem to have arithmetic structure. There's another thing which mathematicians look at, which is called the property of complex multiplication, which you can define easily on the torus. It has to do with an extra endomorphism of the torus given by complex multiplication. And you can generalize that to arbitrary Calabi-Yaus. This also has to do with arithmetic periods. Now, I believe we can convincingly show that these three things, the W equals zero, the rank two attractors, and this complex multiplication points, they're all distinct and that none of them is identical to any of the others, but they all seem to have some similar properties, and I think it would be nice to mathematically understand the connection between these three classes of objects. Obviously, when we get a little further, one could go on and actually make some phenomenological statements, but I don't think we know the space of all vacua near well enough to really sensibly talk about that yet. And then obviously in the long range is the picture I had in the first transparency where we really want to understand what happens between the vacua, the off-shell dynamics of the theory, and how do we think about instantons and more generally off-shell physics, cosmological dynamics, which connects the things. And so for me, this is kind of a route in that direction, but that's clearly a long ways away. And I'll stop there.